in which the theme of the program is, man, there is so much we don't know about how all of this is gonna turn out. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 13th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A brief sampling, if I might, of some of the choice phrases from Fed Chair Jay Powell's, a webinar, an online Q&A, I guess, after a quick set of remarks today sponsored by the Peterson Institute. Anyway, here are some of the relevant things the chairman of the Federal Reserve had to say about this economy this morning. He said there's a possibility that there could be lasting damage, that things are both highly uncertain and they pose significant downside risks, and that fiscal policymakers, Congress that is, although they've done a lot, need to do more.
Additional fiscal support could be costly, but worth it if it helps avoid long-term damage and leaves us with a stronger recovery. This trade-off is one for our elected representatives who wield powers of taxation and spending.
Now, to be fair, Fed chairs for years have been saying the same
Kai,
thing.
Ben Kai, Bernanke, this is Kimberly. Can I interject here for a minute?
Kimberly Adams, you are more than welcome to interject. Welcome to the program, by the way.
Thank you. So, I mean, you know, I cover Washington. And to be fair, Congress has done a lot of things in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. We've had multiple rounds of stimulus. And as we saw from House Democrats just yesterday, they're working on another round.
Well, yeah, but two things. Number one, the House Democrats bill probably is going nowhere because Mitch McConnell, the leader in the Senate, has as much as said so. And number two, this economy, as you know, is defenestrating in real time. And yet here we have Congress kind of going back and forth.
Although that is a great deployment of that SAT word, all pieces of legislation are originally, when they come out of such a bitterly divided Congress, going to be a wish list to some extent. But we should put this in a bit of context, because the first couple of rounds of stimulus really were, oh my good Lord, what are we going to do? Throw everything at this. Let's just try to, again, stop the economy from falling off a cliff. But we also don't know how well what we've done already is working. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi basically said that this morning on MSNBC. Look, we're still waiting on data to see how this works. And Mitch McConnell has also said, look, we need to wait and see how the reopening goes, how what we've already put out there works before we can spend any more money on this. Now, at the same time, the longer we wait, the more the economy suffers. But there is sort of a wait and see moment we seem to be in right now.
Okay, fair enough. Do you think, before we get back to our regularly scheduled programming here, do you think there's going to be another bill? I mean, is there any doubt about that?
Oh, yeah, there has to be more. And I think what we heard from Fed Chair Powell today is even more evidence of that. And everybody knows there has to be more, which means there is quite the lobbying scramble happening here in Washington because everybody wants a piece of it.
Kimberly Adams, our Washington correspondent. More from her later in the program. A planned story as opposed to this unexpected pleasure. Kimberly, thanks a lot.
No problem.
One more item from Powell this morning. The Fed is going to release a survey tomorrow, he said, showing almost 40% of those in households making less than $40,000 a year had lost a job in March. And he pointed out, as he always does, the Fed chair, that it was only in the last couple of years of the expansion that is now over that people on the lower part of that income curve started to feel any of the gains. So there's that from the Fed chair today. Should you have been looking for more evidence this economy is just weird right now, follow along with me, if you would, to the inflation indexes today. The producer price index came out this morning. Those are wholesale prices, down 1.3% in April from a month earlier. You might remember, if you were with us yesterday, that the consumer price index was down as well. Now, falling prices are great until they're not. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what to keep an eye on here.
Now, not everything is going down in price right now. If you're selling masks or hospital gowns, you can charge top dollar these days. Ditto anything that's flying off the grocery shelves. But for most items, from clothing to cigarettes to used cars, prices are going down.
This is the very definition of a fire sale situation.
Jacob Kierkegaard at the Peterson Institute says right now, people only want to buy what they absolutely need. For retailers, that's a problem.
Well, what do you do? Lower the prices very dramatically and basically give people an offer they will find it difficult to refuse.
Though, is deflation really so bad? It's hard to argue with gas under $2 a gallon. But Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics says that's not a huge help.
Gas is cheaper, but people are using whatever dollars they're able to save to handle their economic shock to try to pay the rent.
For consumers who still have jobs and money in the bank, once they start to expect lower prices, they can stop spending too, says Eric Friedman at U.S. Bank.
People hold off on making purchases because they think that potentially prices will fall in the not-too-distant future.
Which will make restarting the economy after the pandemic even harder. All these worries are for persistent deflation, prices falling month after month after month, says Columbia economist and former Fed governor Frederick Mishkin.
It's really not a serious problem as long as it's only very temporary.
He says the Fed stopped a brief bout of deflation during the Great Recession, and its asset purchases, low interest rates, and Main Street lending can be effective in reversing deflation again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Powell spoke. Traders sold. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Those who are looking for promising economic news might consider the housing market. There was word from the Mortgage Bankers Association today that applications for home loans were up last week for the fourth week in a row. And yeah, with interest rates still near record lows, this is a pretty good time to buy. If you can get one of those loans and if you can find a place to buy, which are pretty big ifs. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more on that one.
After weeks mostly stuck in her 960-square-foot condo in Newark, Ohio, near Columbus, with her husband, two dogs, and a cat, Amber Simpson is ready for an upgrade. She manages a dental office, which is gradually reopening. He's back at work as a barista. Now the challenge is finding a place to buy for under $180,000.
It's so competitive right now. I mean, houses in our price range, they're up for 24 hours. They're in contract. They're gone. They disappear.
Across the country, as parts of the economy reopen, buyers are coming back. Sellers, not so much. Susan Wachter teaches real estate at the Wharton School. She says some worry about having strangers in their homes, others about selling in a down economy.
Many, many properties that were planned to go on the market have been pulled. So if you are in the market to buy, it's very difficult to find a home.
And increasingly, a mortgage. Michael Neal with the Urban Institute says as more homeowners struggle to pay existing mortgages, lenders have tightened their credit standards.
I think that there is a concern about the ability of borrowers to actually make their payments in view of the sharp increase in unemployment.
And that increase could turn a dip in home sales into a longer-term slide. Economist Danielle Hale with Realtor.com expects sales to rebound this summer before falling again if coronavirus infections resurge.
We expect the economy and the housing market to be on again, off again throughout the remainder of 2020.
The silver lining for people hoping to get into the housing market? She expects prices to grow more slowly or even fall by the end of the year. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We don't need to remind you, I am sure, that just a couple of months ago, we were living through the longest economic expansion this country had ever seen, 11 years and counting. GDP growth was around 2%, lower than we'd like, yes, but bearable. We had the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years. Things, on paper at least, were looking pretty good back then.
From the economic standpoint, where we're right now is in a disaster.
The longer it drags out, the more likely we'll have a significant financial crisis on our hands.
That's Gary Richardson at the University of California, Irvine. He used to be a historian for the Federal Reserve. And Caroline Foline, she's an economic historian at Emory University. The thing is, and the reason we are talking to economic historians, is that the pace at which we went from back then to now means, to paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld here, if I might, we don't know what we don't know about how this economy has changed and what that's going to mean for where we are going. I mean, yes, sure, we have had big job losses before. There was the Great Depression, unemployment at 25%, the Great Recession, unemployment at 10%, but that happened over years. So is there something else we could maybe compare today to?
The magnitude of what we're doing now is similar to the magnitude of the transition we went through in World War II.
By late 1945, 16 million soldiers had started coming home. The war production that had reconfigured the entire labor force was winding down. And in September of that year, 2 million jobs were lost against a much smaller population base. Total war to peace in a matter of weeks, which meant a whole lot of people were looking for work in an economy that had changed fundamentally. So the government stepped in.
The GI Bill. My father, for example, came back from World War II and went to college.
It helped vets with mortgages and unemployment checks and college educations for 7 million people. But there wasn't just the GI Bill.
They made sure that there was lots of credit available to businesses. The government realized that people were going to go back to some new jobs, not to their old jobs. But the government and most people don't realize what those jobs are.
Kind of like now, right? The Fed and Congress making credit available to businesses and tens of millions of people not knowing what their next jobs might be.
You know, we're in this kind of hybrid situation where it's not really like a financial crisis. It's not really like a war.
And we don't know what we don't know.
We're going to know when we're in recovery, when we know that kids are going back to school and people are therefore able to go back to work and that it's safe to do so.
But, and here's the point that maybe enough people aren't saying out loud, not every restaurant or factory or small business that was in business is still going to be in business when this thing is over.
So the government has to support innovation and entrepreneurship, and entrepreneurs are going to need resources so that they can experiment and come up with the new ideas and the new technologies that are going to get the labor force back to work.
We're at 4 congressional rescue packages, as Kimberly pointed out earlier, and who knows how many Federal Reserve lending programs, I've lost track, frankly, totaling something like $6 trillion, the biggest government response to the biggest economic demobilization since, and this is the point of the whole thing, the end of the Second World War. Unemployment benefit increases, loans to small businesses, bailouts for bigger industries, and direct checks to individuals. But here's the problem with historical comparisons. They can tell us what happened, how it turned out the last time the government went this big into the economy. Can't tell us what's coming. Coming up,
here's Sesame Street. Check it out.
Check it out, we will. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Dow Industrials nosedives 516 points today, 2.1%, 23,247. The NASDAQ sank 139 points, at about 1.5%, finished at 8,863. The S&P 500 tumbled 50, that is 1.7%, 28.20 there. Bank stocks took a big hit. Wells Fargo down 6.2%. Bank of America down 4.5%. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 0.65%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. At the risk of repeating myself here, it is more likely than not that lots of businesses, big ones and small ones, aren't going to come out the other end of this thing. At particular risk, restaurants, which operate on super thin margins in the best of times. But the cold, hard reality is that those businesses closing is a business opportunity in itself, because there are companies, auctioneers basically, that specialize in liquidating bankrupt companies' assets. And a lot of those companies are already seeing businesses pick up. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams, here she is again, has that one.
Often, when a restaurant goes out of business, owners need to get rid of a lot of stuff and quickly. So they hire an auctioneer, but not necessarily a fast talker. Like so many other things, liquidation auctions have shifted online in recent years, with scheduled pickup times, online bidding, and video tours posted on YouTube.
So I'm just going to skim you through the kitchen real quick. Got your prep table, inflate storage prep tables. You got your refrigerators and freezers.
Businesses shut down and liquidate all the time for a mix of reasons. Now, almost all the calculations revolve around COVID-19. BJ Jennings, president of Jennings Auction Group in Pennsylvania, says restaurants where she's based,
they just can't survive this. Being shut for 2 months, how much longer it will be, and then trying to restart their businesses, it's going to be a very, very difficult situation.
Jennings Auction Company is temporarily closed. It's a non-essential business in the state. But she says,
and I expect that once we're able to start conducting business, once the courts reopen to start filing for bankruptcies, we're going to start seeing an awful lot of filings that are going to be for liquidations.
Auction companies tend to be leading indicators of economic hard times, according to John Schultz with the National Auctioneers Association. He works for Grafe Auction in Minnesota, and he says it's not always an easy business.
These are conversations that are bittersweet, right? When these iconic restaurants and bakeries and food service places that, where we commune as people, call you and say, you know, I can't do this anymore. It really pulls on your heartstrings, right?
Schultz is currently talking about liquidation with a local bakery, a fixture of his community. He's grateful for the business opportunity, but also,
it is almost a bit of a mutual grieving process, you know, with the owner of that business and you. Hey, how can I help you move on and close this chapter and start the next chapter of your life?
Determining just when to close that chapter is particularly challenging for small business owners right now. Earlier in the pandemic, we knew very little about how long the shutdowns would last or what reopening might look like. Christopher Rasmus is CEO of Rasmus Auctions, which runs online liquidations in the Mid-Atlantic region.
I think as this epidemic has matured, it's becoming clearer to people what the future might look like, where back in early March, there was no idea what it was going to look like.
For a while, his business tapered off. But in the last week or so, he's been getting more calls.
From successful business people pre-COVID, you know, the preamble was kind of, I never thought I would be making this phone call, but I'm going to need to consider liquidating my business.
Now, if a bunch of commercial refrigerators and bar tables suddenly start coming on the market, that could push down prices, affecting just how much of a loss business owners are stuck with. But for those that are in a position to buy, Pennsylvania auctioneer BJ Jennings says,
they will be able to take advantage of an opportunity to buy good replacement used equipment and furnishings.
And while operations are shut down, some businesses are trying to think strategically. Eric Heidenberger is a partner in DC Restaurant Group, which owns 11 locations here in Washington, D.C. and in Delaware. If the shutdown only lasts another few weeks, he's optimistic he'll be able to reopen. And he's been scoping out some of the online auctions.
There's always repairs that need to be done in a restaurant. There's tables and chairs that, you know, might be weathered. There's refrigerators, there's kitchen equipment.
Heidenberger acknowledges it's awkward to potentially benefit, albeit indirectly, from other restaurants failing. But he thinks of it like a scene from the movie Forrest Gump,
where, you know, he buys a shrimp boat and there's a lot of competition to start. And then, you know, he weathers this big hurricane storm and he's one of the last boats standing at the end. Our goal is to weather this storm as best as we can.
And maybe come out stronger in the end. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
If you've got a kid or two at home right now, odds are real, real good that kid is spending more time in front of a screen than might ordinarily be allowed. Some of that screen time is educational, one hopes. Some probably less so. But back in the 1960s, when an experimental, partially government-funded television show called Sesame Street went on the air, promising to help close the achievement gap in education, the idea that screens could teach at all seemed revolutionary. David Camp has a new book out on that subject. It's called Sunny Days, the Children's Television Revolution That Changed America. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai. Glad to be here.
I suppose we have to start here by noting both the amazing timing of this book, but also the irony of a book about the importance of children's television at a time when more children than ever, I would be willing to bet, are spending multiples more hours in front of screens, right?
Absolutely, Kai. And it's a fair point because, well, first of all, putting out a book called Sunny Days in the middle of a pandemic is curious timing.
Yes.
But yes. All that aside, yeah, because my book starts with screens being this malign influence that all these parents are worried about. Our kids are addicted to television, which was, you know, kind of a novel thing still in the 60s. And now we're facing the same thing. Can screens, meaning the internet, meaning teleconferencing, be used to educate? And Sesame Street and the Electra Company, you know, which were conceived in the late 60s, are proof that it can be done, and perhaps it can be done again.
I will tell you, my mother, who I'm sure is listening to this interview, back when I was a kid, not in the 60s, but she would say, get away from the idiot box. It'll rot your brains. So I hear where you're coming from on that. So look, let's get quantitative about this. Did it work in its intended purpose?
I think it did. I mean, people often say that Sesame Street fell short of its goals because it didn't close the quote-unquote achievement gap between disadvantaged inner-city kids and suburban white kids. But the achievement gap, Joan Ganz Cooney, who's one of the co-creators of Sesame Street, said, put that aside. She said, we were wrong to tout that as one of our goals. But it's her partner in creating the show, Lloyd Morissette, said, any socially distributed good is not going to affect everyone equally. It's kind of like Social Security goes to rich people as well as poor people, but it does kind of offer a lift to everyone. So I would say yes, shows such as Sesame Street and the Electra Company offered uplift educationally. They proved that kids could learn reading and arithmetic by watching television.
So let's get back to where we started then. And with more kids learning from screens and televisions than ever before, even before this pandemic and us all being locked in our houses, what's the lesson maybe that we can take forward as this trend continues, right? Because it's not like the screens are going away.
Right. Kai, I think the lesson is rigorous preparation and preparedness. Because right now with, you know, all these poor parents and all these poor teachers who are trying to muddle their way through this improvised solution to what are we going to do with the rest of the school year, Sesame Street from conception to development took about 3.5 years of preparation, consultation with child psychologists, working with educators and entertainment people too. It's sort of like we talk about pandemic preparedness. We're going to have educational preparedness where there's going to need to be more public investment and more rigorous preparation for online learning, making it effective and also making it fun.
Yeah, but to get back to the original purpose of these programs, right, which was in no small part to not cure, obviously, but ameliorate inequality in this society, we've got more haves now than we ever have and more have-nots. Does this change anything?
I think we are going to have to see more public investment in making sure that the have-nots have the same equipment. Because, you know, just like there are people who don't have laptops and high-speed internet access, back then, the Children's Television Workshop actually had kind of field service coordinators who made sure that there were televisions available to people in underserved neighborhoods. Con Ed, the utility in New York, would lend trucks to drive around poor neighborhoods with TV sets saying, here's Sesame Street, check it out. I think we're going to have to see a similar sort of initiative come from both the public and private sectors to promulgate online learning or part-time online learning anyway.
Right. David Camp, it's a book called Sunny Days, The Children's Television Revolution That Changed America. David, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
We've got an excerpt of David Camp's book at marketplace.org, of course. And while you're there, sign up for our daily newsletter, would you? Or maybe newsletters, I ought to say, because we got a whole slew of them. marketplace.org/newsletters. This final note on the way out today, it's a quickie because we're a tad tight on time. Should you be missing the comfort that only an airline cheese plate eaten stuck in a middle seat on a cross-country flight can provide? We are here to help. Imperfect Foods is a company that takes excess food and tries to make sure it doesn't go to waste. And offering this week, because there's no food more excess right now than airline food. JetBlue cheese and snack trays, $2.99 for 3 ounces of mixed cheeses, dried cherries, and crackers. Have at it. All right, we got to go. Wall Street today, lousy. I frankly was surprised we didn't get the sad wah-wah trombones, but whatever. Our media production team includes Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. A reminder here, they're the ones going into the studios so we can be on the air from home. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.